Psalm 4 was a great standard hymn of the faith of the Old Testament people of God. It was like a mighty fortress, or holy, holy, holy is for us. Something that everyone knew and everyone loved to sing, and the truths of which went deep to the lives of God's people. We know this because of the notes at the beginning of the psalm. It says there, for the director of music. In other words, it's a psalm that is to be sung regularly under the director of music's instruction among the life of God's people. The note also says it is to be accompanied with stringed instruments. And we also know that this was a great hymn of the faith because of that funny word, Selah, which appears twice in this psalm and actually appears frequently in many of the psalms, especially the ones that were to be sung. We don't know exactly what that word means. Some scholars think it means simply pause. Take a breath before you move on. Some think it is a little bit like our amen, so be it, a word of affirmation in the middle of the psalm which the people might give. Some think it gives us some direction about kneeling or even lying prostrate before the Lord as we seek to say or sing the words of this psalm. Actually, my favorite, though, is that Selah means up the volume. It means increase the loudness of your singing at this point. I actually think there's good reason to believe that that's what the word might mean. Sometimes in hymns or psalms, they're to be sung more loudly than at other points in the psalm or the hymn. We know that Psalm 4 was a hymn that was sung in the evening. And we know this because of the last verse, verse 8, I will lie down and sleep in peace. And we know there that Psalm 4 contrasts with Psalm 3, which was actually a morning psalm. The way we know that is from Psalm 5 of verse 3, where it says, I lie down and sleep, I awake again, because the Lord sustains me. So the Lord wakes me up in Psalm 3, and he puts me to sleep in Psalm 4. For that reason, a morning and evening couplet or pair of psalms, some people have actually thought that there is a more significant connection between Psalm 3 and Psalm 4. What is the theme or the issue in Psalm 3? Well, in the note at the beginning of the psalm, it tells us a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. The difficult and obviously hard circumstance in David's life when his own son turned against him and was chasing him through the Judean wilderness and where David was actually fleeing for his life. The issue in Psalm 3 was the physical danger to David's own existence. But the issue in Psalm 4 is not physical danger. Rather, the danger here is to David's reputation. The danger comes not because he is physically being attacked, but because of slander and lies which are being said about David. It is not his physical body that's in question or in doubt or in a difficult situation, but his reputation. And what he needs is not so much the physical deliverance that he cries out to the Lord for in Psalm 3. Rather, in Psalm 4, he needs a sense of the Lord's presence and approval to sustain him in this very difficult time when he's being attacked. There are 7 types of psalms in the whole of the Psalter. Hymns, thanksgivings, remembrances, wisdom psalms, kingship psalms or messianic psalms, laments, and psalms of confidence. Psalm 4 is a combination of these last two, a lament and a song or psalm of confidence. In fact, it moves from one to the other, from distress to quiet confidence in God. It tells of the anguish of someone who is suffering unjustly. And it speaks, therefore, of a fundamental human experience that virtually every one of us has or will experience at one time or another, the experience of injustice of being wrongly or falsely accused. But let me ask you a question just here. Is there any such thing as absolutely, completely undeserved suffering? Is anyone completely innocent? Of course not. Unless, of course, we're speaking about the Lord Jesus Christ himself. None of us is ever totally innocent, which is an interesting clue to how, in very practical ways, we should deal with the accusations that come to us from other people, even when they're false, even when they're slanderous. We should always look for the grain of truth that might be there, the little bit of truth that, though it's overstated, though it's not spoken of rightly or fairly, and without love, certainly, nevertheless, there's some grain of truth in what is being said. There is, however, relative innocence in our dealings with other people. There are times when we are falsely accused, when injustices are heaped upon us, when we are slandered, or when someone wants to advance himself or herself by getting us out of the way, or perhaps someone is simply envious of us. There's a story that goes back to ancient Greece, where there was a fine noble statesman by the name of Aristides, and he was called Aristides the Just because he was such a fine man. Everyone approved of him and thought well of him. There was an election, and one person made quite a public statement of the fact that he was going to vote against Aristides the Just, and when asked why, he said, "I'm voting against him simply because I'm tired of him being called the Just." Do you know that kind of envy? Have you ever experienced it yourself? Where you look at the accomplishments of another person, or you look at something that has gone well for them in their life, and you find your heart secretly, before you would never really want to publicly admit it, finding a way to minimize their success, or compromise it in some way, or in some other way unrelated, actually to bring them down or hurt them. When we were children, we learned the little ditty, "Sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me." But when we were adults, we learned it isn't so. We learned that names can hurt us, and that they do hurt, and that to be falsely accused is one of the most painful experiences a human being can endure. I know. For like you, I have been falsely accused a couple of times in my adult life. And I will tell you that in the days in which that issue was at hand, I felt nothing but pain from my head to the tips of my toes. The psalm teaches us what to do about this pain. It is therefore very practical and very useful. It falls easily and naturally into three points: a lament, an instruction, and then a statement of confidence. But as we look at these three things for just a couple of moments each, it's important to remember that the real issue isn't the outline of the psalm. The real issue is what happens to David and to us when we pray it back to God. And as I think you will see, or I hope you will, what David is actually doing is being changed by the Lord as he prays this prayer. What is happening to David is that he finds himself being changed by the gospel. His life is renewed. The texture of his pain is altered by his praying. Or perhaps more precisely, of course, by the Lord who answers his praying. First then, a lament. What's a lament? It's a complaint. David just flat out tells the Lord how badly he is hurting. The question is, who do you and I complain to when we are unjustly accused? You're at work, perhaps, and you understand someone else, perhaps in another department of your professional enterprise, accuses you of something and is talking maliciously about you. You know their motives. and you know you don't trust them, what do you say? When I was little, I used to watch Amos and Andy on television. I loved it. Well, there's a famous line that Amos once told Andy. He said, "When you bring that allegation against me, I discount it. And furthermore, I discount the alligator that says it." We want to find a way to make sure that everyone around us knows that the person who's bringing that allegation to us is an alligator. And we do our best often to somehow prove that point. Who do you complain to? Perhaps you'd go to a good friend. And that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. But if your friend is really a good friend, he or she will tell you that you must take your complaint to God. That's what David does in verse 1. "Answer me when I call to you, O my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Be merciful to me and hear my prayer." He knows that only God can ultimately help him. In verse 8, he says, "You alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety." Now think with me. Let's be honest. Only God can help me when I'm slandered? Is that what he's saying? I think it is fair and true that in matters that involve our professional life or our public life or our civic life, that when we are slandered or when something is done that is very wrong, it may be necessary and appropriate to seek a legitimate kind of legal remedy in extreme cases. But that is not what David is dealing with here. He is dealing with the personal issues that arise out of such difficulty. He's dealing with that pain that I've already told you about, and I think you understand exists when you are falsely accused. And he's dealing with the ugliness of it all. And he insists that at the deepest level, only God can help me in this most personal of hurts. And the thing to notice here is that David is honest. He doesn't pretend it doesn't matter. He pours out his complaint honestly and openly and bluntly to God. He doesn't pretend that the injustice is coming from inconsequential people. In verse 2, he says, "How long, O man, will you turn my glory into shame?" The word "man" there is, interestingly enough, not the usual word or the ordinary word in the Hebrew language which is used for man, which would be Adam. It's a different word that indicates that the man who is bringing this accusation is a person of consequence, a person of substance, a person of status, whom David rightly fears. So he doesn't pretend that the person giving this accusation to him is of no consequence. And he doesn't pretend that the injustice itself is inconsequential. No, he says, they are seeking to ruin his reputation by turning his glory, that's his reputation, turning his glory into shame. Certainly we know that our reputations are, without any doubt, the most valuable thing that we have. And if our reputations are undermined, everything else goes. It doesn't matter. So David is dealing seriously and honestly with the consequential nature of these accusations as he pours out his complaint to God. And then thirdly, he also doesn't pretend that their motives of the accusers are inconsequential. They love lies, he says. They love delusions, verse 2 says. They oppose his convictions about God. They seek false gods. It's as if David is saying there's an underlying spiritual motivation he suspects in what they're doing. Maybe it's that David's own faith is something that is arousing anger or jealousy or arousing this cause for false accusation. We don't know. But there's something about who he is. There's something about his love for God. There's something about the false gods that these others are following that is arousing them to this kind of bitterness and this kind of accusation and falsehood. So the first thing David does is he opens his heart to God. He complains about the injustice of the people, about the injustice itself of what they're saying about his reputation and about the motives that lie behind their injustices. He complains to God. He laments. He doesn't pretend it doesn't hurt him. There's a story of the pastor who goes to visit an elder parishioner in his church who's having a difficult time, and this sweet elderly lady says to the pastor who has come to tell her that she must not complain about the difficult circumstance in her life, she says to him, "But pastor, when I experience tribulation, God expects me to tribulate a little." And I think we all expect that God would understand that we would tribulate a little when we experience difficult things. True enough. The question is, what direction does our tribulation take? To whom do we speak about it? Oh, there may be one or two trusted friends. There may be, in the context of the church, the need to speak to a ruling elder, a wise, godly man that we trust. But fundamentally, and most of all, we must be honest with God. Don't try and pretend it doesn't hurt. But go to God with that hurt and speak honestly about it. That's the first thing. Secondly, quickly, instruction. There's complaint or lament, and then there's instruction. And this is in verses 3, 4, and 5. If you don't have your Bibles open, please reopen them. This will be very helpful to you as you can look at this or look at the Pew Bible and see in Psalm 4 the way David unfolds this. The instruction is interesting because it's different than we expect. Because David is instructing who? He's instructing those who are out to get him. Even though he is the one who's being slandered and hurt, David is apparently, in these verses, amazingly enough, he is seeking to help his accusers. He speaks kindly to them. He gives them some advice. Verse 3, "Know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The Lord will hear when I call to him." And as David speaks to his enemies, he finds that he begins to answer his own questions. "Don't you know that God looks after his own," he says. And then he realizes that his words apply to him. God looks after his own indeed, and David is one of his own. Like he says in Psalm 5 at the very end, verse 12, which is one of my favorite lines from all of the Psalms, "For surely, O Lord, you bless the righteous. You surround them with your favor as with a shield." That's the promise that God gives to his people. That's the promise that he gives to those who are wrongly accused. He will surround them with favor as with a shield. And so what began as a prayer in verse 1, "When I call, hear my prayer, O Lord," ends up as a conviction, a statement of conviction in verse 3. "The Lord will hear when I call to him." This is very, very practical. Because when we experience false accusations, or when we experience slander of some kind, or when we come to know the mean-spiritedness of people for whatever reason, it is almost certainly true that we, like David, will not be able to actually give this advice to those who are speaking against us. It would be a fairly rare circumstance when they would come to us for advice about how to handle their accusations against us. So what is David really doing? He's really giving advice to himself, you see. But he's doing it in the context of what would he do? He rehearses in his mind how he would handle this if he had that opportunity to have that individual before him. What would he say? And what would he do? Would he call them an alligator? Or would he give them honest advice about how they should handle this matter? And in doing so, he gives himself the advice that he needs. It is curious, is it not, that to the extent that we seek remedy on our own, we seek to vindicate ourselves, to the extent that we seek to vindicate ourselves in the midst of false accusation, usually to that extent we minimize the ability, as it were, for us to receive God's grace and mercy. In other words, all of our energy is being poured out into our own vindication, and our energy isn't being given to sitting quietly and rehearsing what advice I would give somebody in this situation, and therefore what advice I must hear myself. There's a friend of mine who's been in the ministry about as long as I have, and he's a pastor in Arizona. It's one of the most exciting churches in our denomination in Tucson, Arizona, growing like a weed. He's a wonderful guy and a wonderful church. And he used to be on the staff of Briarwood Presbyterian Church in Birmingham. And some of you know that Frank Barker, whose wife, by the way, Barbara, is going to be the speaker at our women's retreat coming up in the first weekend of March. Frank Barker was the pastor of Briarwood for 40 years. And Frank is this wonderful Southern guy, kind of almost like a country guy. I mean, the church just amazingly did amazing things all over the world under Frank's leadership. But he was a very, very warm and very down-to-earth sort of person. And my friend, who was on his staff for several years, was at one point in his ministry there being attacked vigorously by this one person who just was coming after him, very mean-spirited, very ugly, falsely accusing this guy of all kinds of things. And my friend would go to Frank, his boss, his senior pastor, and say, What am I supposed to do about this? How do I handle this? I can't take this anymore. And Frank, according to this guy who was telling me the story later on, just would smile every time and say, kill him with kindness. He said it with a Southern accent, deep Alabama accent that I could never imitate. Just kill him with kindness. That's really what David is teaching himself to do in the context of, as it were, giving advice. He's really being kind. This is what I would tell you if I had an opportunity to tell you. And in the context of that, he learns himself how he is to handle this very difficult situation. Another interesting piece of advice that David gives his accusers and himself is in verse 4. In your anger, do not sin. When you are on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. In your anger could, and I think in this particular context, does mean in your trembling before God. So that the meaning isn't that David is telling his accusers, when you're angry at me, don't sin about it. But rather he's saying, in your trembling before God, when you stand in awe before God, stop sinning as you have been doing. And so the meaning, therefore, of the verse is this. When you consider who God is, stop your wrongs against me. And as you think about this at night, when you lie down on your bed and you can't sleep, search your own heart and stop justifying yourself. And the reason that this is so significant as a piece of advice that David wants to give to his accusers, but really also needs to hear himself, is that the principal person with whom David must deal is not his accuser. It's not. The issue isn't the anger of his accuser. The issue is as David stands trembling before God. And it's God with whom David must deal. Which is another way of reminding us that into our lives, even these difficult things, even these things which seem so unjust and so unfair, they come because a sovereign and loving God has directed that into our lives is going to come a certain kind of refinement. And when God brings refinement to his people, he does not mean us to become alligators. He means us to become those who tremble before him and who say humbly and deeply, what is it, O God? What is it that you wish to teach your son or your daughter in this circumstance? David is reminding his accusers and himself that the real issue isn't their anger against him, that the real issue is their relationship with God. So Psalm 3, lament, instruction, and finally, very quickly, confidence. In verse 2, David deals with people who falsely accuse him and spitefully attack him. But by the time you get to verse 6, he's really dealing with a different sort of person. He's not dealing with a person who falsely accuses him. He's dealing with one who doubts God's ability to do anything about it. So he says in verse 6, many are asking who can show us any good. Let the light of your face shine upon us. When we are wrongfully attacked, what is one of the most painful things about it? It is that we actually begin to doubt what God is up to. We don't get it. We cry out to God, what are you doing? Have you left the phone off the hook? Why is this happening to me? I don't deserve this. And while, as I've already suggested to you, a certain amount of that kind of complaint is honest and appropriate, we must also recognize that we are to bring strong medicine to our doubts. In other words, David is asking, is God really there? Does he really care? Is he really doing anything about this circumstance where I'm being so wronged? And what does David do? He goes to one of his favorite verses. It's sort of the John 3:16 maybe for David. For God so loved the world, you know, a verse that we might use to help us. Or perhaps some of you would go to a verse like Proverbs 3, 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. Acknowledge him in all your ways and he will make smooth your path. Verses like that that we use to help us. What verse does David go to? It's a verse from Numbers. And it's part of a blessing that God gave his people through his servant Aaron. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his face toward you and give you peace. That's it. That's really it. That's what you need. You need the presence and peace of the Lord. Nothing else will help heal your soul from the wounded blows of false accusations. Oh, those blows are dangerous. Oh, they undermine our lives. Oh, they hurt. They are painful. Do not minimize them. But seek the only medicine that will really apply the balm. It is the Lord's light. It is the Lord's face. It is the Lord's presence. That is what we must have. Only the Lord's presence can give us greater joy than when our accusers get everything they want. That's what David says in verse 7. They seem to get everything they want. They get plenty of wine. They get grain in their barns. In other words, we might say, my accusers are eating and drinking and going to parties and having a big old time. They seem to be happy. They seem to be getting everything they want. But David reminds himself that the presence of the Lord is sweeter than anything that they could ever have. And that the presence of the Lord is what I must have if I'm going to endure this circumstance. And the presence of the Lord will be the joy that I need in the midst of this troubling time. None of these things, not wine, not grain, not plenty of to eat, not nice vacations, not the home I want to live in, not all the riches of the planet, nothing will allow me to get a good night's sleep. But God will. God will allow me to lie down in safety when I sleep. God's presence will bless me and clear my conscience. Only the Lord's presence can do that. So lament. Go ahead. Lament a lot. Instruct your accusers and yourself. And then remind yourself of the confidence that you can have of the Lord's presence with you. And there's something else as you think about this psalm and as you pray it back to God. It is in our nature that we are very sensitive to being oppressed, to being attacked by others, to being falsely accused by others, isn't it? Very much in our nature. It is also in our nature that we are often insensitive or even unaware of how we may be oppressing others, how we may be attacking others, of how our words are being heard and felt as the arrows that are piercing another's soul. And so when you pray Psalm 3, don't pray it Psalm 4, don't pray it presumptuously. Pray it by examining your own heart as well. Where am I the guilty one? Where am I doing the very thing that is causing me pain? And in that light, what is the right sacrifice that verse 5 speaks about? The right sacrifice to offer for my sin and for the sin of others? It is the sacrifice of him who stood before his accusers in the Sanhedrin. And as Matthew tells us, the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men have brought against you?" And Matthew says, "But Jesus remained silent." What is the only sacrifice that will work for your accusers? And what is the only sacrifice that will work for you? It is the sacrifice of him who implied with many questions from Herod, and when he was vehemently accused by the teachers of the law, and when he was mocked by the soldiers, he said nothing. He had never done anything wrong. He had never wounded you. He had never hurt those around him. And when they spoke so ill of him, he fell silent. And to Pilate, when Pilate asked him, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they are accusing of?" And Mark tells us that Jesus made no reply. And then he adds, "And Pilate was amazed." Again, there are circumstances in our lives when we need to speak appropriately at injustice being done to us. But be careful. To the degree that you seek to vindicate yourself, to that degree, you may be using your energy in a way that will keep you from knowing the blessing of the presence of the only one who can heal your heart. It is good, perhaps even as you may find it necessary to speak, it is good to remember the one who sacrificed himself, who was oppressed and afflicted, and yet did not open his mouth, who was like a lamb led to slaughter, and a sheep before shearers, and he did not cry out. And because he didn't cry out, and because he remained silent, his sacrifice for you could be perfectly without flaw. So that whether you're guilty or not, whether you should be accused or you should not, there's plenty of wrong in our hearts. And we need that sacrifice. There are some days in our lives that need a psalm like Psalm 4 at their end. There are some nights where the only way we could be able to sleep is to remember the love and sacrifice of the one who remained silent and went to the cross for us. The one who did not sleep on that one awful night when men were pouring out their accusations against him. Don't know if you've ever thought about that horrible night. Jesus almost certainly did not sleep a wink. But confidence in him means that we can do what he could not that night. We can lie down and sleep, for only he can make you dwell in safety. So turn out the light and have a good night's sleep.